Welcome to In the Room with me, Ronnie Barber. In this series, we'll be talking to politicians, YouTubers, sports stars, and scientists about the defining moments of their lives. From the classroom to the boardroom, the briefing room, the dressing room, and a whole lot more, we'll find out how the rooms of our lives shape the decisions we make. This time in the room, I'm speaking to Dame Joan Bakewell, broadcaster, journalist, and Labour Party member in the House of Lords. We'll hear about our early forays into the world of love and sexuality.
Someone took a photograph of our kissing. Nothing salacious, really. Quite straightforward. And they gave me a copy of the photograph, which I had at home. And my mother, because she was the guardian of my virtue, went through all my papers and diaries. I had to seal my diaries with sticky paper in order for her not to read them. But she found the photograph and I was called to order.
We'll learn about the barriers that were put in her way when it came to reading the news.
But I do think you should consider that the time has come to have a woman read the news, perhaps late at night. Nothing too embarrassing, you know. And said, it will never happen, Joan. Just don't worry your little head about that. It's not going to happen.
And how the pandemic has changed the perception of older people in the UK.
I think what COVID has done has made people more tender towards the old. I think it's made people feel it would be nice to look after a granny.
So the first room I put Joan into was her room in Newnham College at Cambridge University when she left home in Stockport to study.
It was the most monumental event in my life. It transformed my whole view of life and the world. And it opened a million doors into ideas and thinking and friendships, all sorts of things. I come from Stockport, which was then still part of the industrial north. This is the 50s. And it was still smoky and rather drab, very Ellis Lowry, you know, and very limited. It had one bookshop, I seem to remember, which I haunted near Mersey Square. And so it was pretty limited in its horizons and its expectations. So against all the odds, I'd got myself into Cambridge, which rather surprised my parents, who came from the inner Manchester. Both my grandfathers had been factory workers. So it seemed quite a big leap. And in those days, it was quite a big leap. And of course, it was to this exclusively female college with this very feminist background. So I went to this leafy paradise called Cambridge. I couldn't believe it. It was so beautiful. I think the concept of beauty first registered and architecture and daffodils along the river and that kind of thing. So it was an amazing place. On the other hand, my room, which you speak of, there was no central heating in those days. Mm-hmm. So we were very, very cold. And I needed blankets and often had my coat on my bed as well. We had coal fires and we were rationed to the amount of coal we had because there was rationing.
Yes.
We only had a little bit of butter every week, a little bit of sugar. Rationing was still, this is 1951, and rationing was still in operation. So it was, today it would have seen a Spartan existence, but it was rapturous at the time.
Let's go back a wee bit then. You had your mum and dad and your dad. You were very close to your dad. I want to talk to you as well about your mum ripping up the picture as well. We'll talk about the photo of an errant Joan Bakewell on a trip to overseas in the bus. But what kind of relationship did you have with your parents, and did the arts thing come through them?
It did in a way, a rather devious way. They were very, it seemed to me now when I look back, pretty intelligent. And as the children of these factory homes, my father was orphaned at the age of 7, they were full of ambition to get on in the world. So they studied a lot at night school and things like that. They were both rather good with watercolours and painting. And I still have them. I have them on the wall. They loved the idea of art. And Manchester, of course, had the most wonderful collection in the City Art Gallery, which I also know well. And so they knew it was a very good thing. They certainly didn't think it was a way of earning a living. So my father became an engineer. And my mother briefly was a tracer. Now, this was before even faxes or anything like that. So engineering drawings had to be done by hand by an army of skilled women. It was a women's profession, tracing. So my mother was a tracer. And there was actually a tracers trade union. It was formed in the late 1880s, I think, for women tracers. But of course, as was appropriate at the time, the moment she married, she became a housewife, because being a housewife and then a mother was considered a full-time job. And indeed, the way she did it, I mean, it was more than a full-time job. She cleaned the house every day to within an inch of its life. No speck of dust must hover.
Yes.
She had to go shopping. There were no cars, obviously. She didn't have a car. She had to walk to the shops and carry home pounds of potatoes and turnips and Swedes and groceries and so on. No deliveries. So she had really quite a hard life. And that that hit against her impulse to self-improve, to go to classes, night classes and things like that. And she filled her with a lot of resentment. And then it created a sort of depression, which I later learned to tolerate. But at the time, living with someone with depression was very hard for me. And I resented it and fought against her. And we were quite... difficult, because she tried to exercise control, which of which she had very little in her life. She tried to exercise control over me. And of course, I was like her. I was going to resist, wasn't I? So I did.
Because let's talk about the photograph, because you go away on it's a trip abroad on a bus. And, and you're at that age and you're discovering boys, and I was discovering girls as well. And somebody took a photograph, which your mother found. Tell us about, because she used to go through your stuff, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She was fearful that I would fall into bad ways, because in a sense, respectable working class mothers always were fearful that their daughters would fall and in fact become pregnant. That was what she was fearful of. But indeed, bring the family into disrepute. I mean, they were enormously self-aware and to some extent snobbish about their place in the world. So off I go on this scholarship, which is a travelling scholarship by bus through the Netherlands. Exotic it to a degree in my time. Fantastic. Thought it was marvellous, and that's where I began to see art and things like that. However, of course, it was a mixed company. Two children from each grammar school in Stockport, including some rather attractive boys, one of whom I set up a partnership with, which was to last, as a matter of fact, for several years. And someone took a photograph of our kissing, nothing salacious really, quite straightforward. And they gave me a copy of the photograph, which I had at home. And my mother, because she was the guardian of my virtue, went through all my papers and diaries. I had to seal my diaries with sticky paper in order for her not to read them. But she found the photograph and I was called to order and asked to account for it. And I said, I can't account for it. I'm deeply, deeply sorry. And I said, I was sorry. I didn't say, that's what all young women do and I wanted to do it and I enjoyed it. I was deeply embarrassed for her, really, for the hurt that she felt it had created. And so she said, well, I'm now going to tear it up and we're going to burn it on the fire. And I never want to hear of anything like that again. So that thus was my sex life launched and blighted at the very start.
When I read about the sex life thing, I immediately realised you and I have a connection, because my parents never talked about sex to me at all. My dad told me about sex when he was poking the fire. And this is what he said. He said, John, he says, and he just looked up. I was having my tea before going to school. And he said, I'll no need to talk to you about sex. And I said, no, Dad. And that was all we ever said. We never mentioned it. So when you talked about that, we had no idea. I don't even remember sex education at school. I can't remember.
No, we had none. You learned from your equally ignorant colleagues at school, the rumour, and you know, what do you think it's like, and what do you think goes where,
yes,
and how does it happen? And so we were enormously ignorant and also sort of completely terrified by the idea that it was sinful and we would get caught out and we would be blamed and we would be punished. So what a trajectory that is.
Let's take the trajectory into Cambridge then, in your very cold room, and you've got this freedom, You're in a learning place as well. What happened to Joan Bakewell then in that environment, that learning environment, that freedom environment? Did you really soak it all up, Joan?
It opened into my mind something that has never closed, which is an insatiable curiosity about the world, which has fueled, you know, my journalistic career, really. It also sparked a bonding with people of my own generation, which I've enjoyed ever since, and indeed with now, as I'm so old, with younger generations. I mean, the generation that was in Cambridge in the 50s was, of course, we'd been children during the war. Excuse me. So we lived as children in great fear that the world was going to end and wicked people would come and take us over. So the fact that we didn't have that now, we had freedom and opportunity, was really very inspiring. And a lot of us had ideas about how to create a new world. We wanted the politics to improve. We wanted to improve the country, the nation, world peace, etc., etc. Hugely idealistic and full of talk. Although, of course, at the time, there were only two women's colleges in Cambridge, 14 men's. Women weren't allowed in the union. Women weren't allowed in the footlights. You obviously, like other students, had to audition to get into the drama groups, which I did. But so we were still, I mean, we're very much a minority, but we were a weighty minority because to have got there in the first place required certain, you know, weight. So we were fluent and voluble and wanted to have our say in Cambridge affairs, which many of us did.
Yeah, because that's interesting. Because in your one of the other rooms, I'll take you into. In fact, I want to go into your office later on because I want to talk about the writing and the campaigning. But that kind of sense of injustice really kind of started there. Would you say you realised that there were things going on in the world that were completely wrong and not equal?
No, it started in the sixth form. It started in my school. There were all sorts of unusual things going on at the time. The Daily Mail, I think it was, sponsored a conference for young people. I didn't go to it, but I somehow read about it. And I knew that young people were founding sort of citizens' councils for the betterment of the world, things like that. And I read about them. There was also quite a lot of activity that bloomed after the war when we could move around and meet each other. So libraries were very important. I belonged to a small drama group in Stockport and I visited the mighty library in Manchester. So ideas were already flowing. I was reading history in the sixth form and it was very relevant. Obviously, all contemporary events are relevant to history, but it was a very crucial time. So all those ideas were being nurtured by what I read and heard. But of course, when I got to Cambridge, I realised that there were all sorts of strands which we could tap into. And indeed, I joined the Labour Club there and met Clement Attlee.
You did?
He came as a guest to the Labour Club in Cambridge. And I went to the dinner and I just sat in awe because I knew he was bringing about the sort of changes I wanted to see. I mean, I and a great many other people. He was extremely self-possessed, but not enormously outgoing. I mean, he was not shy, but he was private, not even reserved. He was private and committed and spoke very, very well. But he was a little unbending. I mean, I think I got his autograph, and he was polite, but not fulsome.
Let's go then into the next room I'm really intrigued to go into, is the production office of Late Night Lineup. I had to go there. The reason I had to go there, because I remember staying up late to watch it. Because, you know, a wee boy growing up in Ayrshire, and I was into art, I was into English, and I was into writers, and I loved talking, you know. And this kind of exotic programme was coming on, and sometimes it was very serious, sometimes it was a bit crazy, if I'm honest. But you landed there, you started off as a studio manager with the BBC.
I did. I was very bad at it. It was a technical job. It required you to understand wires and electricity and cabling. And not only did I not understand it, I didn't particularly want to understand it. I was much more interested in the people who coming into the studio to express their ideas. I was interested in them, not in the cables and the microphones and things. So when you're not enthusiastic, of course, you're not very good at things. You don't concentrate and get it right. So I didn't do that. So I then became an occasional freelance broadcaster. And it was a time, you know, in the 50s, even to the late 50s, people in the BBC believed that radio was the real focus of the BBC. And there was something frivolous called television. There was just a lot about light entertainment. And indeed, Television Centre had only just been completed. It was a glittering new building out in Shepherd's Bush. Oh, it's not at the centre of things, we all thought, in radio. So I did then apply, because people said there are so many jobs in television now. I mean, any of us could walk it. So I thought, good, I'll have a try. I failed several auditions, but each audition I learned more by watching what the other people were doing. So what is it? What is it you do when you interview someone? The answer is you don't interrupt very much unless they're running away with you. And you learn to listen very hard, the art of listening. And then I kept applying. And then someone who was starting up a new programme at the opening of BBC Two asked me to go and meet them and would I like to try. They were doing a late programme. It was a promotional programme. Came out of the promotions department of the BBC. Well, the promotions people write trailers and things like that. So they're not in the mainstream of programme making at all. This gave us free rein to do and to create the anarchic programme that you enjoyed so much. Because we had no one in control of us, really, except our editor, who shared a sense of fun and sense of let's make it up as we go along. And we did. It was on every night of the week, 364 days a year. It was off on Christmas Day. And we had a rota of presenters, and I was one of the presenters, one of four, for about 6 years. And I did about three programmes a week all round the year. No holidays, closing down. Newsnight closes down for the summer, doesn't it?
Yes, no. But it interesting to see you're one of four. That was three men you were one of, right?
That's
and
right.
You're a very patriarchal society. The BBC then was men, and women were seen as kind of, we'll cater for them, but we won't get too much. What was it like then? Did you feel yourself as a feminist? Because you're burgeoning feminist early doors anyway, but did you feel that sense of resentment that women were seen as something just to bring out to pretty things up?
I didn't feel resentment. I felt very lucky. I just felt I was so lucky that in this world that was clearly run by men, for men, and made by men, I was allowed in. And so I was, in fact, quite conformist. I wanted to do the job well, particularly as the job involved meeting and interviewing the most amazing range of people. And my colleagues were all very sympathetic. We were all in our late 20s, early 30s. So we were wanting to make crazy programs. I mean, we had the Pythons were just coming together then. They hadn't created Monty Python, but I remember Terry Jones and Michael Palin coming on to try out their jokes. So did Edna Everidge,
yes.
Barry Humphrey.
Yes.
It was a place where we could try out new ideas. And we loved it because it was BBC Two. It had a small audience, very late at night. There was no retribution if you did something too outrageous. Once or twice, it got a bit out of hand. But we were allowed to do what we wanted. And we each had our different specialities. And it was where the old grey whistle test idea began. Because one of our producers was very, very keen on the burgeoning pop music world. So we had people like Elton John and...
Wow.
They all came on because they wanted airtime. They didn't care what the programme was. We rang them up and said they'd turn up. The Stones came on. Alan Price, people like that, all of them. And they recorded in the afternoon. And it was a bit wild. The afternoon sessions were hilarious, but they recorded, that's what they wanted, airtime, and out it went every night, most nights actually.
And I can still remember the excitement because I never always, because we didn't have the Radio Times or anything, so I didn't always know who the guests. Sometimes I got the feeling you didn't always know who the guests were going to be either, which was fabulous. But there was one point, talking about the patriarchal thing, you did question whether women would ever become newsreaders, and you were immediately slapped down.
Yes, I was. I should say before going on to that story, which is worth telling, the office behaviour, because you are now in the office, the room, was underpinned by the support of a lot of extremely bright, eager women secretaries. Women secretaries, women PAs, and a woman producer. There was a woman producer who was excellent, Pat. She was just terrific. So there was a sense that there wasn't a sense among the company that men were bossing us around. We were doing our job and they were doing their job. So it was a very friendly, sort of collegiate enterprise altogether. I loved it. I didn't want to do anything else, but it did occur to me that it was about time that a woman read the news. So I went to see the head of news called Derek A. Moore and said, I'm not here because I want promotion or I want a different job or I'm perfectly happy where I'm doing. But I do think you should consider that the time has come to have a woman read the news, perhaps late at night. Nothing too embarrassing, you know. And he said, it will never happen, Joan. Just don't worry your little head about that. It's not going to happen. Wow. And I sort of, well, why not? And he said, well, I'll tell you, he had three reasons, actually. Women's voices are too shrill. Women's emotions are too near the surface and they will get stressed by bad news. I can't remember what the other one was. We don't feel like it. I can't remember what the other reason was. But so I left just thinking, it was a go. I had a go. We'll keep on having a go. And in fact, it was not many months after that that I think ITV had... ITV did it first with Alan Ford. And then Angela came along later. And she was, and of course, so the pace of change quickened. As we knew it, women knew change would come. Men weren't ready for it, didn't want to have to accommodate it. So they were lagging behind.
Stifling. But, it strikes you as well, in this part of your career, you were very much into kind of, the analysis, the heart of matters, programs like that, where you looked at the spirituality, the moral aspects of life. Was that something that you brought to the BBC? Was it a phone call to you? How did that kind of part of your career develop?
That happened later. I left Lineup in the 70s. In fact, Lineup finished in the early 70s. So I looked around for things to do. And in fact, I went to Granada and did we invented a sort of consumer program. We were one of the first consumer, you know, joining in, solving problems programs. There was a whole entire department of the BBC called the Religious Department in those days, usually staffed by people who were ordained, men, of course. There weren't any women ordained at the time, but women who would have been, who were sort of deans and churches and laity, distinguished ladies from the laity. We did a lot of programmes about Christianity because it was an established church and the religious department was Christian. That's how it was. But slowly I was invited to do interviews with people who were considered out of the mainstream, by which I meant Jewish people. The occasional is Muslim, I think, but that was seen as rather daring. That was opening up new channels. Well, we were keen to do that. I mean, anyone with ideas did always, within the BBC's creative world, want to extend the ideas. It was just that the BBC was very wary of losing its loyal audience or offending. There was always a fear of offending because, as you know, the BBC depends for its license fee on government legislation, and to offend the government might get you into trouble. But we were quite pleased to offend people because we thought that was quite a way of stirring up ideas. And so I did work for the religious department. That's what happened. And then decades later, I would go along to receptions, you know, white wine drinking parties, very modest and well-behaved. And I was talking to someone whom I didn't know about being part of the religious department. I said, well, of course, I'm really interested in ideas as much, I'm not a devout believer, but I think it would be interesting if there was an occasion within the religious department to do involve people with other ideas and share these ideas, other religions. There are so, you know, so many different diverse intelligences and scholarship and so on about these. And I, that was the end of that. I drank my white wine and went away. And the next day, my agent rang and said, you were talking to someone who commissions programs. And he would like the series you suggested. And I said, I didn't suggest a series. He said, well, it involves you talking to people of different faiths. And I said, I'll do it. And thus was a program invented. And I did it for 10 years. It was called Belief.
Let's move on then, because I see you're sitting in your office now. You're sitting in your office, and I could go anywhere here. I could talk about your writing, because you're a playwright as well. You've written for radio. We could talk about the fantastic landscape artist program as well, because of which I love, and we've talked about it, my watercolours. But I want to talk a wee bit, because the last time we talked, John, you won't remember, I was at a radio station and you were the voice of the older people. You'd been made the kind of, I don't know if it was the president, but the spokesperson for it anyway. And I remember you, and I remember how, I can't remember what we're talking about. It might have been about the 60s women with the pension and things like that. It might have been something like that. But you were really campaigning for the fact that the aged, older people were getting kind of ignored and almost sidelined in any kind of argument about the future. And you were brilliant that day. But tell me about that campaigning side of you and almost an injustice.
I welcome that opportunity. I have to say that all these different strands that you refer to of my life are born of the fact that I've always been freelance. So I've never been beholden to a corporation or signed a major commitment to a job for many years. Never done that kind of thing. So I'm always trailing my coat, looking for opportunities. And people come up with ideas, and sometimes I like them and sometimes I don't. So that's how my life has pieced itself together. So Harriet Harman got in touch when she wasn't part of the Labour government, and they were putting through an equality bill. And she said, we'd like to have someone who's not a parliamentarian, but who would speak up for older people. And they will have to be someone who's quite old, and they will have to have some journalistic skills. And we wondered if you'd like to try. And it was unofficial post, unpaid. It was just informal. Nobody told me what I should do with it. And I said, I'll have a go. So I think she'd been intrigued by the fact that I ran an article for The Guardian called Just 70. I mean, there used to be a teenage magazine.
Yes.
And Alan Restringer let me invent this column called Just 70. And I wrote about what it was weekly, about what it was like, different things about being old. And she was aware of this column, which had then become a book. And so in a sense, I'd got it was my stepping off point, because from then I went round with responding to every single event that governed older people's lives. Older people have a much stronger voice now. There are far more of them. But at the time, they were, for example, if they took redundancy at 50, they would find it very hard to get a job. If they, if women lost their job in their 50s, well, they regarded as unemployable. So it was really tough. And the pension was running behind. It didn't have the triple lock on it, which we now have, which secures that the pensions rise in certain ratios to average earnings. So there was a lot to campaign about, and I managed to do it. I didn't have any particular way to do it, but I became, every journalist got my phone number, or if they wanted a comment, they would phone. So I was able to push it under my own kind of steam. And of course, once the announcement that I was to become what the journalists called czar for older people,
yes.
Then I got lots and lots of mail. I mean, the mail just poured in with stories of people's lives. And I had to feel those as well as I could. I couldn't come up with answers, but I could offer people routes by which they might find solutions. And I tried to urge them to be as assertive as possible, you know, to go to the citizens' advice, to ring their MP, to go round to see their MP. MPs are enormously susceptible to pressure from their constituents. They don't get enough of it, but they have to pay attention to it. So I encourage people to find their own voice. And I rather enjoyed doing that because I realized what a cohort of people. I wasn't alone. I wasn't going to grow old into some lonely, isolated widowhood, as it were. I'm divorced, but, you know, I live on my own. But there were millions of us, and we were all very determined. We were staying fit and exercising our intelligence in the world.
How do you think the pandemic has changed the perception of older people? Do you think there is, because we know that sadly and tragically, so many older people have succumbed to COVID. And there has been arguments about this kind of the idea that the vulnerable, we have to, you know, it's a weighing up the economy against the health of people. What do you think the pandemic has changed the perception of older people then? You know?
I think it's made everyone aware that the old are at risk if we don't care for them. And I think that's very good because there is a certain callousness, which is not difficult to share, which is they're very old, these people. Honestly, they've had their lives. What about us? We haven't had our lives yet. It's our turn. And I have a certain, if I say sympathy, it doesn't mean I share that view, but I can understand people having that view, particularly young people, students who are missing out on the fun of being students and that kind of thing. So I can understand that people's reluctance to worry about the old, because the old are seen as rather a drag. You know, they don't know about pop music. They don't walk quickly. They get in your way on the roads. They take ages at the counter of the shops and so on. So I think what COVID has done has made people more tender towards the old. I think it's made people feel it would be nice to look after a granny, to take care of some old dear in a care home, because they're extremely grateful and often with wonderful life stories to tell and pleased that you should show an interest. You'll always get a welcoming smile from an old person because they're so unused to being, you know, in the mainstream. So I think there's a tenderness there being shown to them, but there's also a kind of, what are we going to do about them? Because they're at risk so much. And I think Christmas is going to throw up a big problem for people and their grandparents. Grandparents want to hug grandchildren, yeah, there's no doubt about it.
I certainly do.
I do too, and it's a real deprivation, So it's a physical deprivation. We're actually suffering organically as animals from what we expect to do. I mean, there is no animal that doesn't cherish its young, and we want to do that, and we're inhibited. So that's a tremendous stress. And I think that leads to a good deal of mental, you know, depression.
I have to talk about the portrait artist because I have to talk about this because I'm fascinated by it. The Joan Bakewell that turned up at Newnham College in Cambridge, did you ever think she would be presenting an arts programme with one of the top comedians in the country, Frank Skinner? And I'll tell you what, Joan, it just fitted the two of you. If somebody, I could imagine in a commissioning office somewhere, right, let's do an arts, well, you know, Joan Bakewell, yeah, fine, yeah. Who are we going to get to go with her? And Frank Skinner just came out. And I know Frank's into his arts, but that, and you look like you're enjoying your time with him.
We did, and we got on very well, and we're still friends. And when there was a letting up of the lockdown, he came round for tea. And I made him scones, and we had scones and tea together. And we're good friends. He's got more degrees than I have. He knows about art. He goes to galleries. He cares about it a great deal. He's got a very lively mind, jumps all over the place, but it's enormously rewarding. And of course, now I present it with the actor Steve Mangan, who is a great actor, wonderful. And he too has got a Cambridge degree and so on. So I get on with these people enormously well. I think that's because the whole bedrock of the programme is based on a sort of camaraderie among both the crew, the creators, the presenters, the judges, and so on. So it is a very well cast team. You will know that how that important that is.
And do you enjoy working with new people? Do you like the new people, the younger people coming through? Do you get a kick from that?
Well, it's interesting because I do know a bit about art, but I don't know much about techie stuff. And of course, the young people, it's just no effort at all. So I'm always calling on them to, I'm meant to do this. Could you just come and adjust my laptop for me? Could you? Oh, yes, no problem. Clickety, 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 click. And they aren't solved all my problems. And they are enormously easygoing and generous with their advice. They take knowing all this stuff for granted. And that really, you do feel your age when you can't do all the intimate stuff. But that's another bond too, because it indicates, you know, that we don't aren't necessarily the fount of all wisdom. There's lots of wisdom that goes on among the young. And I was berated. There was a wonderful Nihal. There's a wonderful DJ called I can't
Nihal. Remember. Yes, I know. Yeah, yes, I know from Radio Five Live. Yes, yeah,
Five Live. That's right. And he was talking to me about I've been doing throughout the lockdown. You know, I've been doing Portrait Artist of the Week on my laptop every Sunday morning. I don't know whether you knew that.
I didn't.
We did nine programs, and Nihal was one of the guests, and he was bemoaning the fact that sort of my generation didn't understand the nature of rap lyrics and how creative and how challenging they were. And I thought, no, I don't. I mean, that's a real shortcoming. And I was pleased to have it pointed out to me. So I'm trying to remedy that soon.
It's fantastic. So, go on to it. Sorry, John, I wasn't listening to you properly there. I interrupted like a bad interviewer.
I talk too much. That's the other thing. One of the things about being in lockdown is that when you meet anyone, you want to talk forever. I mean, I'm talking about someone you meet in a shop or someone behind the counter, because you've been locked up silently for days and hours, and you meet someone passing by and you want to pin them to the wall and say, do you know what I think? I think this and I think that and so on.
I think sometimes the social distancing is just for an excuse for people to avoid talking to you, because you're thinking, I spoke to them for the last half an hour the other day. Can we just talk just finally about your writing and the column you do as well? Is there anything you're ready to put into book form, novel form? Is there something hanging around your head?
Oh yes, I'm just ahead of you there, because when the lockdown came, I had just completed moving house, downsizing, which of course old people have to do. A lot of old people are sitting in houses with three bedrooms. They live in one. And they can't do the stairs. So they want to downsize, and it's very hard to do. Well, I did it, but it took me over a year to do it. So I've written a book about it, and it's going to come out. I used the lockdown to finish the book, and it's coming out in the spring, I think. It's called The Tick of Two Clocks, the two houses that I have lived in.
I'll look forward to that.
So it's anecdotal about what it was like to move. Quite a lot of diaries and anecdotes. But it also tells people, there's my phone going, tells people things that they need to know if they're going to downsize, because it's really big undertaking. And it's hard taking it the older you get, because you don't know all the shortcuts.
Many thanks to Dame Joan Bakewell. Next time, I'll be talking to Stylian Petrov, the Celtic and Aston Villa legend, who played football until 2013 when he was diagnosed with leukemia.
What I see is a cancer ward. And I'm thinking, something's not right here. Something is not right.
I'll see you next time in The Room.